I'm sitting in a rental car outside a prison in Pennsylvania where my ex-boyfriend is being held by the Department of Homeland Security. It's a frigid day in January, the winter back-to-back blizzards buried the Northeast. But I've driven down from Brooklyn during a break in the storms, arriving just as the light is starting to fade. By 5 p.m., the parking lot where I'm waiting has turned ominous, prison floodlights interrogating a landscape of black and gray. Inside, Graham can't see daylight, a frequent complaint during the 5 months he's been a prisoner here. The only windows in the dorm are up near the ceiling, too high for any kind of view. He once described how the inmates would stand against the wall whenever a strip of sunlight entered at an angle. As the sun lowered, the light moved higher on the wall, the men following it with their faces until it was out of reach. Hearing stories like this has made me appreciate the things you take for granted when you're free. Last summer, I'd watched the sunset across the East River as I ran along the Brooklyn waterfront, newly conflicted about the Statue of Liberty in the distance. In the fall, I noticed the leaves swirling around the sidewalk, stopping to pick one up so I could share the seasonal shift with Graham. At home, I set the leaf on a piece of paper and carefully traced around the edges, knowing I couldn't send him the real thing. Technically, inmates aren't allowed to receive drawings, one of many rules I had to learn, but my tracing made it through the mailroom. Many letters didn't. The ones that did were often tough to read. I just wish I could breathe some fresh air, feel the wind, smell the trees, feel the sun or the rain on my skin, Graham wrote to me just after he arrived at the Pennsylvania prison. Every day here is very painful, lonely, and long. No matter what you do to break it up, there's a limit to how you can use up 16 hours a day with nothing to do. I was sympathetic to his complaints, shocked really at how he and the other prisoners were treated. But after 5 months of helping him and fighting for his release, I'm worn down by the whole ordeal. It has also taken a toll on me. My cell phone rings. The noise seems louder in the car, startling me as I fumble to answer quickly. I can tell from the number that it's Graham, which means I can't call him back if I miss it. "You have a call from an inmate at York County Prison," the familiar recording begins. "Press 1 to accept the charges. Press 2 to decline." I hold the phone closer to make sure I press the right button, anxious because Graham shouldn't be calling me now. He should be in a van heading to the parking lot, or busy dealing with paperwork, or changing out of his prison uniform into street clothes. I'm here to pick him up because he's supposed to be released. "They haven't called my name yet," Graham shouts. I move the phone a little farther from my ear. "It's after 5 and they haven't called my name yet. They've called other names ages ago, but not mine. I can't fucking believe it. What is going on?" "Don't yell," I tell him, reflexively worried, even now, that he'll once again lose phone privileges. "I'm in the car, in the parking lot. The van isn't here yet." By now, I am an expert at remaining calm, offering support, being optimistic. Back when we were together, Graham looked on the bright side and I imagined every possible worst-case scenario, but I'm starting to panic too. I've made this trip once before and drove home alone when Graham didn't get released, so this time I told our lawyer I wasn't leaving Brooklyn until the paperwork had actually been signed. "Go get your man," he'd said when he called earlier today. "The judge just signed the order. They're going to release Graham before 6. I look at the clock glowing on the dashboard. It's 5:13. "Everybody is asking why I'm still here," Graham says. "I have no idea. No one has told me a fucking thing. I'm just sitting here waiting, all fucking day, watching the clock. I can't take this anymore." Graham's Scottish accent is always stronger when he's venting, despite living in Brooklyn for almost 20 years. "Go talk to your counselor," I suggest. "Maybe he can find out what's going on. The visiting area is closed, so I can't do much out here." What I don't tell him is that I don't want to leave the car in case I miss the white van I'm expecting, hoping it's just running late. The paralegal had warned me that if I wasn't right there to collect Graham when the van brought him to the parking lot, he'd be driven to the bus station and dropped off, with no coat, no ID, and no money. That is one of the cruelties of a system operating in the shadows of the law. Even though Graham was picked up by Homeland Security in New York City last August, it's his responsibility to get back home. Not that he has a home to return to. He lost his house during his downward spiral towards prison, so he's going to stay with me until he sorts things out.